The views, ideas, and content of Well Seekers and their guests are their own opinions, and you should always seek additional professional help around any of the issues discussed here on Well Seekers.
Welcome back. We're so excited to have our guest today, Ryan Dusick. Ryan is an associate marriage and family therapist, the founding drummer of Maroon 5, a mental health coach, speaker, and advocate, and the author of the book, Harder to Breathe, a memoir of making Maroon 5, Losing It All and Finding Recovery. His life has been a long and winding road from aspiring pop star with anxiety to heartbroken alcoholic to thriving mental health survivor and a messenger of hope in recovery. And we're so excited to have him here today. Hey, Ryan.
Hi, thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, welcome. Thanks for sharing your journey and your experience and your stories and some of the solutions you've found along the way. So I want to start, your book is beautiful. I just said that to you off air, but it truly is. And I highly suggest it, and we'll put the link below so you all can check it out as well. But when you start at the beginning of your life a bit in your book, tell us about what your dreams were as a kid. Where did your dreams start for life?
Well, my dreams were certainly not as big as they became when the band, found our path later in my early adulthood. But as a kid, I grew up in Southern California in Los Angeles area. And I was a big baseball fan. I dreamt of being a pitcher for the Dodgers someday. I think that was my first real big passion. But other than that, I was just a good kid. I did what I was told, mostly, pretty responsible. My brother and I were high achieving, overachieving, I think you could say, kids. My tendency was to be sort of perfectionistic, and I didn't really think of it in this way because I was an innocent at the time, but I think I put a lot of pressure on myself and probably had some anxieties and things long before I had any words to describe what that was. But I wanted to, I looked at my parents. They had seemed to have a pretty good life. They're still married today, done well for themselves. And I think I just wanted to have, a good life, just live the sort of American dream. That was my first idea of what my life would be. But then it all kind of took a left turn in my teenage years when baseball, which had been my passion, became a problem. I was a pitcher and I had arm injuries, which kind of sidelined me and made that real difficult for me. Right at the moment that music became my new passion. Mm-hmm. When I was 12 years old, my older brother Josh started playing the electric guitar. Or actually, started a little before then. I was 12 when I decided to pick up the drums because I wanted to be like my brother. Not exactly like him, but, following his footsteps. He was playing in the school band and he had his own band. And I thought that was really cool. So, he turned me on to music and first the classic rock, the guitar gods that were his influences, Eric Clapton and Jimi Hendrix and Jimmy Page and all the great blues guitarists. And so naturally I gravitated to, classic rock drums. And and then before I knew it, I was playing in the school band in the eighth grade and with my older brother and his band. And that became my new passion. It was kind of fortuitous timing that it was that moment in history in the early 90s when sort of very organic alternative rock came to the forefront. And bands like Nirvana and Pearl Jam and Soundgarden, that was my music at a point when I needed something that would be defining of me, something to connect to that was bigger than me. So that was it. That was the turning point. It was when my passion went from childhood things to this at least seemingly very grown up adult rock and roll.
What did music do for you? Because I know as a musician, music was sort of my first way of connecting to emotions and putting words to feelings I couldn't actually describe when I was speaking. What was music to you when you were playing?
Music for me at that moment in my life when I was about 14 years old and really starting to play the drums seriously and really finding the music that spoke to me, it represented freedom and connection and expression. A freedom in that it was, I think every generation wants to find something that defines them separately from what came before them, you know, their parents' generation. And this music kind of offered me an outlet that felt like it was mine and nobody else's. Of course, there were millions of other kids probably feeling the same thing at the same time. Mm-hmm. But it was also nice to be a part of that, to feel like I belonged somewhere. Because I was, you know, I was in high school at this very, very elite sort of college prep high school, where there were a lot of overachieving kids like me. And whereas I had been, you know, a big fish in a small pond in my elementary school, now I was just one of a lot of kids that were on track to go to an Ivy League school, or, you know, had parents that were very high achieving themselves. And so, you know, I think that in that environment, I had some issues just in terms of feeling like I fit in. I kind of felt like I was the kid from the other side of the tracks. And I was into music, and I was a sensitive boy. You know, I felt my feelings, and I don't know, mm-hmm. the music, you know, listening to Kurt Cobain and Chris Cornell and these guys that were writing very heavy lyrics and singing passionately about some, you know, dark things. I felt like I was understood. You know, I felt like this was a place that I had a connection to these artists. And so that gave me this sense that I belonged. And then it became expression for me. It became, when I was playing music, I was getting out those things that were pent up inside that I didn't really have a language to express at that point in my life. As, you know, being so young, and, you know, the public discourse on mental health and things that we struggle with were, mm-hmm. you know, it wasn't what it is today. Not that we're, you know, there yet completely either.
Totally. Yeah, not at all. Not at all.
But it was, it was that feeling that I had an outlet.
I have a good, we talked about this a little on email. I have a good friend that went to that school. And it's funny, she describes her experience as just eerily similar. Just feeling like she didn't belong there. And a lot of the same things you talk about in the book. So maybe it's just the school, or maybe it's just a feeling, right? But I'm curious how your anxiety, because it sounds like you always struggled with anxiety. How did it increase once Maroon 5 went from high school band to where we know it today? How did that affect your anxiety in that process?
Well, I think that anxiety was something that I experienced, but it wasn't the forefront of my mind, or at least I didn't understand it to the degree that I do now as a kid. I was a shy kid. I was kind of introverted. I was comfortable in my small group of friends and with my family, but in new environments, I was socially anxious, not very outgoing. And then in high school, feeling a bit alienated from my surroundings, and feeling this darker side of me kind of emerging, I often felt just kind of disconnected. Kind of, I would walk around campus and almost feel dissociated, a little bit lightheaded, like I was hyperventilating, or there was a difficulty in my throat kind of to catch my breath. And so I was noticing those symptoms, but I didn't have the word anxiety to put to it at that point. It wasn't until I was on the road with the band, and, you know, the thing that had been my outlet, the thing that helped me cope, the music and the playing of the music, went from being a passion and something that was just fun and expression and freedom to now being expectation and pressure and performance anxiety and imposter syndrome, feeling like, who am I to be here in front of all these people that are paying to see music? Because I was a self-taught drummer. I taught myself to play the drums in my parents' garage. I never took a lesson, which is saying a lot about, you know, natural talent or natural, inclination to sort of just have that ambition and take on that challenge. But I missed some things in the process, you know, in terms of technique. And so I started noticing that I was having difficulties that maybe other drummers weren't having. And it just really became, not very quickly, but over time, an issue for me on the road, where there was this feedback loop between the challenges that I was having playing and with this sort of self-doubt, going into a feedback loop with my anxiety, you know, where I wasn't somebody who had a lot of stage fright for that. I always looked forward to our shows. And if anything, I would have described it more as excitement than anxiety. But now the excitement was kind of morphing into anxiety because every night I didn't know how it would go. And I was kind of psyching myself out.
So how did you cope with the anxiety? At that point, you're on the road, you're touring. It sounds like, gosh, the irony, right? That this thing that helped you deal with emotions and anxiety was the thing that was now fueling it the most, right? Yeah. So what I hear in that is then you're left with nothing, right? You don't have the tools and strategies to cope with your anxiety. So how do you deal with it at that point, Ryan?
Well, I'd like to tell you that I dealt in a really healthy and productive way.
We'll get to when you do, but how how did you then?
Well, I think that the first time that we went on the road in 1997, when I was a baby, I was 19 years old, and we had our first record deal, which was just crazy. You know, right out of high school, we got signed to a major record label, Warner Brothers, and put out this album, and everyone thought it would be a big hit, and we'd become, you know, the next Beatles or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that was the first time that I noticed some of these symptoms and was having a little bit more difficulty on the road. Fortunate for us, you know, it didn't get to the point where we blew up at that point and had the huge pressures of being stars. So I was a little bit disconcerted by the fact that playing was becoming more difficult, but it didn't escalate to the point where I had a real problem. But then when we put out the first Maroon 5 album in 2002, I had had a moment of time in my life in my early 20s between those two albums that was very positive. I don't know how I had the sort of emotional maturity at that point in my life to recognize some of the things that I had been doing wrong the first time around and correct some of them. You know, I'd been a very, as I said, introverted person. On the road, I was just homesick the whole time and took a very sort of negative attitude about the whole thing. As much as I enjoyed being with my friends on, you know, in a van driving around the country, I was just tired and missing my family and missing my girlfriend back home, and just had a very, just kind of a negative approach to it, looking forward to the time off and not embracing the journey. And I had just, I think up until that point in life, because I was shy, kind of been closed off to new opportunities, closed off to new people and things that were maybe intimidating or just new and different and uncomfortable for me. So during that time, I had adopted this new attitude that was much more helpful to me in terms of just being open to change, being open to the possibilities of what new people and new situations in my life might lead to. And that led to a wonderful time when I went back to school at UCLA. I made a lot of new friends. I had a lot of fun. And this resurgence in the band came out of that. So my strategy going on the road the second time was I'm just going to take that attitude on the road with me. I'm just going to be open to all of the experiences, be as positive as I could be and treat it like I'm still in college. I'm just taking it on the road. Just want to take every day for what it's worth and appreciate the opportunity and whatever that means. And I think that was positive to a large extent and worked for me for maybe about a year and a half, 2 years on the road, during which time, you know, if we had a night off and we were in a college town, I'd be like, let's go find a party, you know, let's go to a frat house. Or, you know, if we were in a new city, I was just like, I wanted to soak in the sights and go to the local hangs and do all that stuff. But, you know, the lifestyle got more and more exhausting. It got more demanding and the pressures kept mounting as we became more successful and our album and single kept moving up the charts and the venues we were playing were getting bigger and we were getting opportunities to play on TV and to do all these things that you dream of, but you stack them all on top of each other after you've been traveling for months and now years. And I think that coping skill of just sort of pushing forward and being positive and embracing everything at a certain point ran out of steam because what I wasn't doing was taking good care of myself. You know, mm-hmm. I didn't have any real downtime to rest and recuperate. My one strategy for, you know, dealing with anxiety was kind of blowing off steam. And it's like, we have a night off. Let's go out and tie one on. let's go hang out with the locals. You only live once, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's, again, there's pros and cons to everything. I think there's positive aspects to that strategy, but in the end, because the life was so demanding, because what I was asking of my mind, body, and spirit was so great, at a certain point, it was just too much.
It's so interesting. What you're talking about, it sounds like you had this sort of self-willed presence for like a year and a half. But it wasn't necessarily founded on like a connection to what you were talking about, like spirit or strategies or tools or right. It was like, I'm just going to will my way into presence and being present instead of my following my anxiety. Right. And then it just stopped working. Does that feel like that's what I'm hearing anyway?
Absolutely. And I feel like that's the one thing I run into when I hear or read, you know, a lot of people talking about, you know, just the positive mindset. Powerful as that is, sometimes it can verge on being slightly toxic, because it's like, it's not all just about motivation and willpower. That doesn't get everything. If you just try to push through whatever's in front of you and you don't stop to sit in the present moment and actually deal with the things that are coming up from underneath. And oftentimes you're just kind of pushing down the things that are actually the real issues for you. And in pushing forward, you're neglecting things that need your attention. And sooner or later, that's going to catch up with you.
1,000%. And you're actually, I know positive psychology. I have a colleague and we go toe to toe all the time with this, because I do think it is toxic positivity. But that's another debate, I guess, for another time. So if we fast forward, Ryan, so now you're in this, you're like truly in this. When do things start taking a turn for you, and how does that lead to you needing to exit the band, or rather being asked to exit the band?
Well, I think it started to become a real issue on our first headlining tour. We had been opening for bigger acts and even playing arenas and things, opening up for bands like Matchbox 20 and John Mayer. John Mayer was the first artist to offer us an opening gig in an arena. So that was a big deal. But we finally got to the point where we were the headliners and we were doing, you know, our own headlining tour. We had, you know, a song in the charts that was our first single, Harder to Breathe, you know, a gold record at that point. And we were just getting ready to take it to the next level. You'd think you're a couple of years in already, you've already, you know, spent all your bullets. But now it was like the next single, which is going to be the pop hit, This Love, was coming out, and the album was coming out internationally. And it was just at this moment, as things were really, it was like the tipping point for the band, that I was really starting to grapple with some serious issues. And it started, you know, when I think about it in my memory, there may have been signs before this, but there's one moment that stands out in my mind. We were doing three nights in LA, sold out in our hometown at the start of our first headlining tour. And the first two nights went really well. Great crowd. I mean, just like incredible deafening streams and people singing along to our album, and, you know, just the kind of rock star dreams you have when you start out as a band. And the third night, I think we did like two radio appearances. We played on the Ellen show that day, I think. And then we did.
Oh, what year was that?
I think it was fall of 2003.
Oh, okay. I was on that show a couple years later, but that's interesting. Okay. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. So, and then I think we did something on Kiss FM, and then we got to soundcheck the third night. And I went up on stage and I picked up my sticks to start checking my drums. And I just like, my hand was shaking, my right hand was shaking. And I tried to just hit the floor tom to check it. And my hand was doing weird things, just like kind of freaking out and not, I just couldn't pick up a stick directly up and put it back down in a smooth motion. And I was like, very concerned. What is this? What's going on? Somehow I got through the set, you know, I just figured out how to kind of contort my body and use different muscles to play through what had been some pain in my shoulder, but now became this sort of discoordination in my right arm. And then after the show, you know, of course, closing night, three sold out nights. We had everyone, all of our family and friends we'd ever known in the audience that night. And they all wanted a piece of us. We wanted to go out and party. And I had to, you know, sign a bunch of autographs, and I could barely sign my name. You know, my hand was shaking so much. And so right as we're having this wonderful moment, there was this deep, dark feeling inside of me that something really bad is happening to me. And I didn't feel like I had any control over it, and that this is going to end really badly. And I, you know, my only coping mechanism at that point, and for the next, whatever it was, 6 months or a year that I continued to play after that, was to just keep trying harder, was just to keep pushing through it and take a positive mindset and just, you know, grab the sticks harder and bear down and just mind over matter and pretend like this thing that's happening isn't happening. But it just kept coming back, you know, stronger and stronger. And, eventually it got to the point where it was very obvious to the band, the rest of the band, my bandmates, that there was a problem. My playing was getting worse. And so, you know, I would have kept playing until my arm fell off, but they, you know, at a certain point came to me and said, I think you need to go home and figure out what's going on with you. And it, you know, if it's something that takes you a month or takes you 6 months or takes you a year, you know, we'll be here when you get back. Just the first thing is you got to take care of you. Now, that was very sweet of them and, you know, certainly the right thing to do. But at that point, I had been playing through the pain for a long time and contorting myself and trying to find different ways of doing it that my mechanics, which had already been, you know, untrained, had gotten to the point where they was totally unmanageable. I built up all these really bad habits and I'd done a lot of damage. And more important than that, you know, my self-esteem had just gotten really battered and my self-confidence, and what had been imposter syndrome was now, you know, I don't feel like I can play the drums anymore. And I was losing, you know, total coordination behind the drums. And so I went home and I went to every kind of doctor you can imagine, you know, an orthopedist, neurologist, psychiatrist, you know, every kind of doctor, inflammatory specialist, to figure out what was wrong with my arm. But I felt and I knew that this was bigger than just my arm. There was something to my core that was wrong, that was defective in some ways. That was the way that I felt. And so I went from suffering and pushing it down to just all of that kind of coming to the forefront and really struggling. For a year, I tried to come back. I did every kind of physical therapy. I had injections. I was medicated on all these pills, doing acupuncture, doing all this stuff. And during that time, you know, started self-medicating more because I was really struggling with the pain of all of that and watching my band from afar as I was nursing my wounds from back home. And things went from bad to worse because I just didn't really know how to come out from under all of that. And so it was when we were getting ready to make the next record, the follow-up to Songs About Jane, that the band called a meeting. It's the start of my book, Harder to Breathe, the first scene in the prologue, because that was kind of the pivotal moment when everything changed for me, you know, from everything I've been working towards for over a decade to all of a sudden, all of that is gone. You know, it was my entire identity at that point. They were, you know, the band was my best friends. It was my passion. It was my, all that sense of connection and purpose that I described earlier in the music and in the brotherhood of us, you know, this common passion that we had with each other. All of that was gone. And so I just felt really, really broken at that point in my life and went into definitely the darkest period of my life.
I mean, the grief and loss that comes with losing a career, right, in general is tremendous. And then on top of it, it's like, and this is how it works so often, right? It's like you have one challenge like anxiety, and then it breeds another challenge like alcoholism, it sounds like, is what you went into. Would you define it as that? I know you talk about recovery a lot.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And then the grief and loss of your career on top of it. So Is that rock bottom for you, Ryan? Was that rock bottom when you said, okay, it's time to get help? Or what was the point? And I know you talk about this in your book, but just for people listening, that you say, okay, now it's time to like start finding a different solution to all of this.
Mm-hmm. Well, you would think that rock bottom would have been when I had to leave the band and was, you know.
Not just, with alcoholism. Really, I know a thing or two. It's like, yeah.
Yeah, it was the same kind of thing of just kind of pushing things down and denying the reality of the situation. Those are all the cycles of addiction, right? In the book, I refer to it as the illusion of control, which is a phrase we use sometimes in recovery. I named one of the chapters that because it was so much a part of my psychology. You know, I just I had control over the feelings if I used the medication, you know, this chemical solution to the pain that I was in, which obviously was a rationalization for my addiction. And then when the addiction was causing problems, I had, you know, the illusion that I had control over it because I could take a break from it for a week or a month, or I could, you know, say, I'm switching to beer and wine instead of hard liquor, or I'm just only drinking after 5 o'clock, you know. All these illusions, all these rationalizations that we create in our mind. And when it was reaching a more substantial, well, I don't know if it was a more substantial rock bottom, but it was a more holistic rock bottom. Mm-hmm. I mean, my mind, body, and spirit were all really suffering to a degree that I had to reckon with the fact that what I was doing to cope was actually making the matter worse. And if I kept doing that, it would keep getting worse until something really, really bad and tragic would happen. Fortunately for me, it didn't get to that point where I ended up, you know, doing something really stupid and ending up hurting myself or someone else, or ending up in jail, or, you know, doing permanent damage to my body, or, you know, the kind of tragic things that you can see happen when you have, when you live the addictive life. And you end up with a DUI, you end up, overdosing, or all the things that can happen that can be tragic. For me, it was really just feeling really sick and tired, physically and emotionally and psychologically, feeling disconnected from life. And that's the spiritual element. You know, just feeling that my world was really small. I felt really isolated. I felt that I didn't have any real sense of meaning or purpose in my life, you know, and that is the part that's hardest to overcome. Like, there are people that have physical ailments and they deal with them and they go through their life and they find meaning and purpose in their life and life is worth living. When you are living a life that is essentially trying to replace, connection with self-medication, then you've sort of eliminated the reason for it all, right? And I just, I didn't have, you know, the profound sort of intellectual understanding of this at this point. I just knew that I felt broken and that I didn't want to live that way anymore. And that if I kept doing it the way I was, it would get worse. So I had to try a different way. My way of doing it was not working. And so maybe somebody else's way was going to be the answer. That was, of course, terrifying at that point in my life, because we fear change. We fear the unknown. Even if what we know is miserable, at least it's familiar. And so there's comfort in familiarity, and changing that or stepping into a space that was new and different and uncomfortable and having to give up the things that I knew that were my coping mechanisms was scary. But I was ready. You know, I had tried a couple times. I'd kind of dipped my toes into the pool of recovery ever so lightly a couple times, but this time I had really been humbled, and fortunately I had some good direction and some support from people that cared, who pointed me in the right direction. And I checked myself into the Betty Ford Center here in Southern California, and that started a whole new journey that I couldn't have anticipated where it would take me, but it was an awakening, to say the least.
Yeah. And awakenings are just the most beautiful thing, in my opinion. But I always say, right, when your solution is alcohol and we're asking you to let go of that solution, right, for this unknown solution, that's a tough ask. It's almost an impossible one. And it usually takes that rock bottom that really generally is never physical in my experience. It's usually like an emotional, spiritual rock bottom to let go. And then this new set of tools comes in, right? And I know that those tools are wide and vast and they come in many different like variations for people. What were the tools that most resonated for you, Ryan, that you grasped onto in recovery or otherwise, just now as a therapist too?
Well, it was interesting because early on in recovery, essentially, I was just playing catch up, you know, trying to deal with all the things that I'd been pushing down. And I really did need to be in the inpatient setting because on a daily basis, I was having panic attacks and dealing with the withdrawals and, you know, needing to be sort of looked after. But it was really helpful that I was able to process everything that was coming up. I had multiple, therapy sessions on a daily basis, whether it be individual or group or meditation or, you know, 12-step meetings. All of those things were helpful, but what was most powerful for me pretty early on was noticing that even when I had just a couple weeks of recovery under my belt, all of the stuff that people had been offering me as I was just kind of getting acclimated to the process were now things that I could pass on to the people who were just coming in. Mm. And realizing that in that moment, I had something to offer another human being in a helpful way. And that was more purpose than I had in a very long time. You know, I had been avoiding and running away from that kind of responsibility or that kind of connection. And this element of service, you know, giving of myself in a helpful way to somebody who could really use even 2 weeks of wisdom that I had gained in recovery, you know, to be able to even just walk somebody to their room and hand them the itinerary and just tell them it's going to be okay. And just kind of acclimate them to the process the way that the guys had done for me. Like, that was a powerful feeling. That was something that I had been lacking in my life. And it was very connecting. It was very uplifting. And it gave me this feeling of fulfillment that I had forgotten about, you know? And so that was the driving force early on, was following that feeling of purpose, of that feeling of purpose that came from being of service. And it led to this, I guess I would say, a spiritual awakening, because it was a reconnection to life. You know, feeling as isolated and broken as I had, this was the opposite of that. This was, you know, feeling, really like I would belong to something larger than myself. And I did. And I followed that, you know, for a few years just with, I actually volunteered at a recovery center for a couple of years after I finished my program. And I was doing the 12-step meetings, and I ended up, after I worked all the steps, I'd be sponsoring people. And so it was really that feeling of service. So it kept me on the path of recovery, but also was starting to offer me this whole new identity. Mm. You know, I was getting a lot of positive feedback about the ways in which I was working with the people that were just starting recovery. I was telling my story in groups and finding that people were responding well to that. And that self-confidence that I had lost, that self-esteem, and more than anything else, you know, identity and purpose, was being reshaped by all this new wisdom that I had gained through my suffering and through the work that I was doing to overcome it. So it was not innate in the ways that maybe love of music had been, or, you know, the sort of natural proclivity to play music. This was something I had earned through living. So mm-hmm. That was a powerful, you know, lesson about life and the things that can come, the gifts that you can receive if you can see even the struggles as potential gifts. And it led to this feeling that maybe this is my new mission in life. Maybe this is my new purpose. And I hadn't really considered it in terms of career, but I had others that were recommending that I consider it. And I had other people that I noticed had done similar things in their life in middle age, or, you know, gone back to school and found new careers in counseling or related fields. And So I just took the leap one day. I said, let me see if I can get into a grad school program for a master's degree to become some kind of counselor or therapist. And it turns out, even though I had an English degree undergrad from UCLA, I was able to get into Pepperdine for their master's program in clinical psychology. And so a month later, I'm sitting in class and learning all about psychology and about, you know, diagnosis and how to treat people. And that was just mind-blowing. You know, I didn't have a five-year plan that said I was going to end up. I just had the next indicator in action. You know, what's the next thing that feels... And it went from it was the long form version of me telling my story the way that I have in meetings and at the recovery center. You know, it just turned into this another level of therapy for me and an opportunity to step into service on a bigger scale, because now I think that the gift that everything I went through has given me is that I have a gift to offer others. You know, it's advocacy. It's being able to contribute to the public discourse, to be a part of destigmatization, to offer hope to people that might see themselves in the struggles that I went through. And so that was the purpose and the mission for the book, and continues to be a part of everything that I'm doing. And again, no 5-year plan, just all this stuff. Speaking, getting into the crowds and doing public speaking, and I'm reading a lot of writing, and become a coach as well as a therapist, and who knows, in another 5 years what I'll be doing. But it's all just part of this the knowledge that I've gained that, you know, it's connecting oneself to some of the things that are larger than yourself, that brings that spiritual meaning in your life.
I think you talk about it so well with we all have something to offer, even if it's not what we think it is, right? When you talk about showing up for someone who has 2 weeks less than you, right? There's always something you have to offer someone wherever you are on your journey, whatever point. And also just the presence, again, Ryan, is what I pick up on, just because I'm a big believer in just showing up and being present and seeing what unfolds itself, right? And some of the strategies that you probably teach now to clients that I've worked with clients and just personally and professionally about just being present for what is, which is hard. I mean, it's truly, truly hard to just sit and be present and then just to let life unfold, right? But it's probably one of the most beautiful gifts that I feel like I've gotten, and it sounds like that you've gotten as well in your journey.
Yeah, I mean, that's something that I ran from for a decade. Yeah, it obviously was difficult. You know, I essentially, by self-medicating and by avoiding any real connection or responsibility in my life, I was essentially saying sitting in the present moment is intolerable, right? Mm-hmm. That's what I was training myself to believe. And I think that's... When I was in recovery, when I was at the Betty Ford Center, it's the reason why meditation was the hardest thing of anything that we did. You know, it was unloading things that I was dealing with was helpful, but just sitting and being still and sitting with my breath in the present moment was overwhelming.
I experienced the same thing. And again, I just watched people go through it too. Isn't it the most beautiful part of your day now, though? I do like breath work and being in yourself. It's like, it's a hard sell at first when there's other tools like self-medication, but in your experience, I mean, I'm just sharing my experience. I think it's the most profound and beautiful moments of my day is just being still with me and a connection to something greater or my breath. Is that been your experience as well?
Oh, absolutely. I've come to crave it. And I realized early on, beyond, you know, just the support that I was getting from my peers in recovery and all the tools that were being offered me, for me, the two things that were most helpful just in terms of daily practice of self-care were to start my day with mindful stretching and breathing, just starting the day off right with centering myself in the present moment, just, you know, limbering up and acclimating myself to the feeling of being in my body, really feeling the stretch of each muscle and the way that the breath feels slowly going through, you know, each muscle as I'm stretching. Like that just sort of set me up for more serenity in my day, you know, to be more comfortable in the present moment. And then the other thing, because, you know, you have a lifetime of anxieties and other things that, build up. And it's not like you go away completely. Life is life, and we all deal with stress and things that can be challenging, no matter how much recovery or how many tools you have. And it's good to have your sort of daily practices and then your go-tos in terms of things that work when all else fails, you know? And for me, early on, it became, I was never somebody who liked to take baths, but I realized that when I'm in warm water, you know, everything kind of slows down and calms down a bit. And if I would just, you know, sort of recite my mantra and focus on my breathing while laying in warm water, it just became a way to sort of let dissipate all the things that had become very stressful or frustrating or angering or, you know, or depressing in my day and week. And my mantra, I can, you know, some people won't tell you their mantra, but for me, it was part of my recovery, you know, the serenity prayer, which is all about acceptance is one part of it. And then, you know, focusing on the things you can control rather than the things that you can't control. And just reciting that over and over again while being present with my breath and trying to just relax and calm, pretty much without fail. If you do, if I did that for a half an hour, and to this day, when all else fails, if I do that for a half an hour, I'm going to come out of that bath with a better focus on what it is that I should be focusing my energy and my mind on. All the things that had gotten me to that point where I'm feeling, you know, swept away with whatever emotion I'm feeling has now been redirected to something that's actually going to be more productive, right? So those tools were things that I started to crave. And this just mindfulness is a part of what I work with my clients on. And it, everyone's resistant at first because it's antithetical to most people's being. And also just culturally, I think we believe that the answer to any problem is something we have to do. You know, we have to do more. We have to try harder. We have to push. And sometimes it's called for to take action. But I find it's much more productive when you can take a state of being into doing, rather than just pushing away the present, pushing away the things that we're not dealing with and pushing forward. So really it's more about being present. And even if you're doing, being able to be present while you're doing, as opposed to being essentially in the future, which is someplace you can't be.
1,000%. It's that concept of leaning into the fear and leaning into the discomfort with a new tool set. And it's faith too. It's asking people to come along in faith that there's a different way, right? Which again, it's a hard sell sometimes, but it's worth it at the end. Ryan, I want to be respectful of your time. Just one quick question and then a final question. Have you ever done Wim Hof? Because it's exactly what you, oh my gosh. First of all, you have to do it. But it's like, it's essentially what you're talking about, except cold water. And there's so much research on cold water immersion and what it does to anxiety, depression, and just polyvagal theory. I don't know if you're into that. It's something that I sort of geek out on a bit. Are you familiar with that?
I am. I'd be lying if I said I was fully versed in it, but I have a lot of colleagues who are and talk about it. And I'm familiar with what it's all about, but I should study it more.
Yeah. And well, to anyone listening, Wim Hof is worth checking out. It's essentially the cold version of what Ryan was just describing in his warm bath. Before we let you go, just one final question. If someone is struggling right now, whether it's with anxiety or alcoholism or some sort of sense of loss or feeling of, you know, losing their self-identity, what words of hope would you offer them?
Well, the interesting thing about hope is that it's there even if we can't see it. You know, sometimes we've become blind to it. That was the case for me, you know, being where I was and going through a grieving process and sort of running away from life. Hope was there even when I couldn't see it. It was just when I woke up to it that things changed, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to remember that and to look at your situation and remember that, you know, sometimes it's our own defenses that might have been there for good reason, but are getting in the way of us being able to see that hope, you know? So the openness to let down our defenses, the openness to be vulnerable, the openness to accept change, as scary as it may be, those are the tools that will lead to finding hope. And hope is so crucial to anything, because when you have hope in your life, then things become possible, right? And when you don't, it's really it's a tough place to get started from. I know it's a chicken or the egg kind of thing. It's like you need to have the belief in order to get the hope, but the hope is what you need to do that. But it's there. It's there even if you can't see it. So just, you know, allow yourself to open up to it.
That's beautiful. Ryan Dusick, Associate Marriage and Family Therapist, the founding drummer of Maroon 5, and the author of the book Harder to Breathe, a memoir of making Maroon 5, losing it all, and finding recovery. We'll put all his links below so you can check him out and the book. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. This was great. Thank you.
How would you like to join the conversation? Email us anytime at hello@wellseekers.com.